A woman riding solo on a motorcycle following the coastline of India. An adventure and physical and mental challenge for local author Connie Stambush. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, ride along with Connie aboard her Royal Enfield Bullet as she shares her travel memoir, Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India. Exotic sights, sounds, and smells as the traveler visits Hindu temples, encounters intriguing characters along the way, including an ill-fated romance, and survives a crash, threats, and extreme heat and cold. Quite a ride. I'm David James. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Okay, are you ready for a grand adventure? Riding solo on a motorcycle, thousands of miles, following the coastline of the subcontinent of India. From congested cityscapes to desolate backroads, and being a woman alone in an often threatening male-dominated society. My guest chronicles this odyssey through India in her just-published travel memoir, Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India. As a female traveling alone, she endures taunts, assaults, and a serious motorcycle accident. She also shares the rich and mysterious culture of India with its temples, goddesses, and the many kind and giving people she meets along the way. C.L. Stambush, Connie, is an Evansville native now working in publications at the University of Southern Indiana. As a journalist, writer, and editor, Connie Stambush has lived, worked, and traveled in more than 20 countries. Her articles have appeared in the Chicago Tribune, Cosmopolitan, Far Eastern Economic Review, and Traveler's Tales, and in national and international newspapers. After living and working in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East for 6 years, Connie returned to the U.S. and became a national motorcycle safety instructor. Connie Stambush, welcome to 2 Main Street. I really enjoyed your travel memoir. And let's start with your trusty steed on this journey around India, a Royal Enfield Bullet motorcycle you named Kali?
Yes.
Tell me about Kali.
Well, I named Kali after the Hindu goddess of destruction and rebirth, okay, which sounds a little scary, but she really stood out as the goddess for me for this journey itself. As I was trying to rediscover myself, I knew I would have to go through some trials of losing myself to gain myself back again.
Now, so, Kali is a frightening goddess. I knew four arms, severed limbs as a skirt, and shrunken heads as pearls.
Yes, she is very frightening to look at, and in her, but she is also the incarnation of many goddesses. I think the Hindu goddesses and gods are a little difficult for Westerners to understand, but there is one goddess, the mother goddess, which she represents, and then out of her are like 350 million different goddesses. So it gets rather complicated, but she has both the good and the bad in her. So the half side carries weapons, and the other half shows benevolence with the way she positions her hands and things.
So tell us about Bullet. Your bike.
Yes, the Royal Enfield Bullet. It just seemed like the perfect vehicle to ride in India. In the years that I had been living there before I decided to take this journey, you could always hear this motorcycle thump, thump, thumping through the streets of India. And when I decided that I wanted to undertake a travel on my own, because I had always gone by bus or train or boat or something like this, this was going to be the first time I ever actually navigated my own vehicle. And a motorcycle, as opposed to any other vehicle in India, just seemed the perfect one, because two-wheelers are just everywhere. And then having heard that thump, 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 I got that reverberation of that bullet in me, and it just seemed like a calling, like that was the one.
British made?
It is originally British made, but since the 1950s, it has been manufactured in India.
So it kept the title Royal Enfield.
Yes.
Which sounds very colonial.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yes. And I talk about in the book how its first incarnation was as a bicycle. For the Townsend Bicycle Cycle Company, I believe it was. And then the advent of motorcycling came along, and so that bicycle sort of morphed into a motorcycle, and then it kind of grew. But the motorcycle that I had, that I bought in 1997, was the same manufacturing and engineering from the 1950s. Not a lot had changed in it.
Now, you were working in New Delhi when you got the idea to leave the office environment there and hit the road. So what were you doing in New Delhi?
I worked for a wire service called the Women's Feature Service, and my job there was as an editor. So what our role was to take stories from women around the world and then shape them or edit them so that they would fit mainstream media.
Now, when you decided to leave this office environment, what was the initial reaction to you taking this solo dangerous trip?
It was, I thought that I would be sort of cheered on as this woman, because it was a women's news service, so we were all women working there, and I thought that they would be very, like, go girl type, but they were horrified, in fact, that, and I was told that, you know, you can't, it's not safe, you shouldn't do it, and I wasn't going to listen to them, I guess.
Now, before we hop on aboard Bullet and motor south from Delhi, let's return home and learn more about your growing up in Evansville. And I know you went to Bossy High School, my alma mater.
Yes. Lived over just behind Washington Grade School. So I went to Washington Grade School, and then we moved over onto Baird Park. So then I was just a few blocks from Bossy High School at that point.
You write in your memoir that you were timid growing up and not someone who would likely to embark on this dangerous journey in a foreign land. And I know there was something your father told you that guided your way, and you can go anywhere, do anything, and be anyone you want. Has that been your kind of guiding light?
I have grown into that. As you said earlier, that I was, I write about being a timid girl. And I believe we all have this sort of memory or this idea of who we are in our heads. And what got stuck in my head very early on was that I was kind of afraid of life. And I have this vision, a memory of myself sliding one shoulder along the hall wall of Washington Grade School. Even when I was alone in the hall, I still felt most safe, sort of attached to this thing. And it seemed to me that I didn't like this image of myself, this being afraid of life, afraid of trying life and living life. And both my parents were always encouraging me and supporting me that I was capable and able and everything. And they were giving me dance lessons and, you know, anything to sort of bring me out of my shell. But there was this moment when I was about in my early teens, 13, 14 years old, where my father just sort of stopped me as we passed each other and looked at me and sort of blurted out, "You can go anywhere, do anything, be anyone you want." And of course, I was like, "Oh, no, I can't," because that's not how I saw myself. But that, though, his words stuck in me. And I think there's a lot of power in the words that other people tell us and then the words that we tell ourselves, too. So my journey in this book is really about overcoming the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and the stories other people tell us about ourselves and what to believe.
And you have one reference in your book, which I can relate to the museum bear. And that has to be the giant grizzly bear at the Evansville Museum that hovers over this hallway.
He's
terrifying. I think every little kid remembers that.
It's terrifying, and he's still there. But he's up now in bright daylight and behind a glass case now. So, and he doesn't look nearly as large as he used to. But when I was a kid, the Evansville Museum had sort of an auditorium underground or in the lower grounds. And that bear used to be tucked into a dark corner.
Sure.
And my mom would always take my brother and I there, and we would go around that corner, and I knew that bear was there. And of course, they would just pass on by, but I'd be stuck, terrified, on the other side of the bear, wanting to pass it, but just sure that the minute I started moving, it was going to reach out and, you know, claw me or something. So it took a lot of guts to get past that bear eventually.
Now, you're a motorcycle aficionado, and you learned to tinker with the workings under the hood, courtesy of your dad.
Yes, I'm always fascinated with the way things work and understanding how and fixing things. I've got, you know, that real sort of tactile side of me. And my dad, you know, cars back then were, you could work on them easier than you could today. So he was always, you know, kind of keeping ours up. And I was just fascinated with the whole garage scene and mechanic scene.
My guest is Connie Stambush. She's the author of a new travel memoir, Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India. So, Connie, where did you go to college?
I went to a lot of colleges, okay. I would say. I went to U of E for a while. I went to Ivy Tech for a while. I went to USI for a while. I ended up getting my final degree from IU in journalism with a minor in business. And then I was kind of a late bloomer in the education course because I worked for Mead Johnson in the factory for 9 years before I started going back to school and getting my degree. And then I got my first degree from IU in journalism in 92, I think it was. And then in 2008, I got a master's in creative nonfiction from Sarah Lawrence College in New York.
You were a proofreader?
Yes.
At Mead Johnson?
Yes. I read the package inserts, those tiny little...
Oh, my gosh, that nobody else reads.
That no one else reads, exactly right.
But you have to have those.
You have to have them, and you have to make sure that they're correct and everything. So that's what I did. I did oncology drugs.
Oh, my.
I couldn't pronounce half the words that I was reading, but... yeah, I did that for a couple of years.
Wasn't your job going to be moved to New Jersey?
Yes. So in the late 90s, early 90s, around 92, Mead Johnson announced that it was going to relocate to Princeton, New Jersey. And I was really interested in relocating with them. I saw myself sort of climbing this corporate ladder mm-hmm. and being this corporate person. And we were all nervous about whether we would even have a job offer because some people would be made redundant and they wouldn't, you know, have a job. And I was fingers crossed that I would, and I did. And when I looked at the offer, I wasn't all that thrilled with it because the cost of living there would be a lot more than Southern Indiana, yet I don't think my salary was really going to change. But still, I went to bed pretty sure that that's what I would do, and I woke up the next morning saying I quit. And that's when I decided to sell everything and go abroad.
And so where did you first go when you went overseas?
I flipped a coin to decide where I would land because I really wanted to start in Ireland up there, but winter was sort of coming on and I didn't want to carry a lot of extra clothes with me. I wanted to travel as lean as I could, even though I was far from lean in my travels in the beginning. So in the end, I decided I would flip a coin to, say, either the cheapest place in Europe or to Ireland. And it turned out to be the cheapest place in Europe, which I think I landed in Frankfurt, Germany.
Mm-hmm. Now, by yourself?
By myself. And then went, uh-oh. Now what?
Did you have the blessing of your mother on this?
I did. My mom has always been the most supportive and the most amazing person. And she has always taught me to live the life that I choose. And that, I think, has just been the greatest gift any kid could get from their parents.
Now, you stayed in Europe. You didn't go there for a couple of weeks or months. You stayed.
You know, I intended to be gone 6 months at least and no more than a year. That was the plan when I left because I figure 6 months is when you need at least that much time to figure out what you're doing and whether you like it or not. And any more than a year, I thought I would be in real danger of not returning. Turned out it was 6 years, so.
So did you... eventually run out of money and have to get a job?
I did have some jobs along the way. And I did come back to in that 6 year period, I was back in the United States for two visits.
Okay, so how did you end up in India, Connie Stambush?
Well, I had been living in the Czech Republic for, like I say, about 8 to 10 months or so. And this was right after the Velvet Revolution, and a lot of Americans were coming over and discovering Prague. And Prague was known as the Paris of the 90s. So it was full of cafes and people in black turtlenecks writing the great American novel. And they were just everywhere. And this was just not what I had signed up for. If I was going to be abroad, I wanted to be someplace exotic where I wasn't surrounded by a bunch of countrymen. And so, frankly, most of my friends didn't really know where India was back in the 90s. So that seemed like a pretty safe bet that I could go there and not find a lot of Americans.
So you went to India without a job?
I had a tentative agreements with some newspapers. So I called around editors working for major newspapers like the Houston Chronicle and the Globe, the Boston Globe, asking if they would need a stringer, basically a reporter in India to file stories. And I had only one international editor, a guy at the Houston Chronicle, said that I could call him collect if I had a story. Now, this was all, you know, pre-internet and everything. So that was good enough for me.
Mm-hmm. So you settled in Delhi, of course, a huge city, a sprawling metropolis with all these different cultures and everything. Did you find an apartment right away?
I ended up, when I first landed there, I stayed in an area called Paharganj, which is known as like where the travelers go. Mm-hmm. And it's very cheap rent down there and not very nice, I should say. I don't know how it is today, but back then it was just cheap. And I stayed there for a while. And then, of course, I met some other journalists from around the world. And there's some like press clubs and things like that you can go to. So I started meeting a few of those people. And then one person let me stay with them for a while until I was able to secure an apartment of my own.
So you worked at this news service for a while, and then you decided, well, I want to do something differently. And then you decided you wanted to take off on this journey to visit temples. Why the temples?
My contract with the wire service ended after 1 year, and I didn't think that we weren't going to re-sign again. And I knew I wasn't ready to leave India yet. But I didn't know what to do with myself, and I had been wanting to explore India more on my own. I decided to visit the temples because a friend actually suggested that, but I felt like I needed some sort of guide to get me around the country. India is huge, and I needed to know where I was going and how, and keep me sort of on track if I was actually going to complete this. And I wanted something a little bit more than just just to ride the edge of India. So these temples turned out to be sort of located, well, theoretically located, pretty much along the edge of India. And that sort of coincided with my idea of riding the edge. So I thought, oh, we'll just put these two together. And visiting these temples, which were where these pieces of the goddess Kali came to rest. So the goddess Kali, it's kind of a long story. It's explained probably a little bit better in my book. But she was sort of, in her other incarnation as Sati, she was cut into these 51 or 52 pieces, and they all landed in different places in India. And where they landed, these Shaktipeet temples are now built. And Shaktipeet means a power temple. So they're sources of power. And I thought, well, this is also good for a woman, you know, alone to sort of go to these different pieces.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk about the first leg of Connie Stambush's search for self on the edge of India, those first encounters with bias against women, wonders along the way, hardships, and a frightening encounter with ladies of a different order. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Connie Stambush, author of a newly published travel memoir, Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India. An accomplished journalist and editor, Connie's works have appeared in national and international publications, and she has received numerous awards, scholarships, and residences Also on her resume, being a national motorcycle safety instructor. We'll talk about that later. Now let's get back on the road on this trek along the coastline of India. India, of course, we mentioned, a very complex country. Many different languages, cultures, traditions, landscapes, extreme heat, and extreme cold. Now, Connie, you did not seek out the usual tourist destinations like the Taj Mahal. You found these temples on the map and tried to visit as many as you could. And early on your trip, a near disaster, your gear is suddenly missing, and you were freaking out.
Yes, yes, yes. I had a pack that I had strapped to the back of my motorcycle. The Bullet, yes, mm-hmm. The Royal Enfield Bullet. And I thought that it was secure, but at some point I began to realize that it was starting to slip. And I was very close to ending the day's ride and was getting kind of lazy. And so rather than stop and get off and resecure the bag, well, I just decided to keep going. And when I reached the hotel or the destination for the day, I noticed that when I got to get off the motorcycle, I swung my leg over and noticed that it cleared just too easily and something was wrong. And that's when I saw that the bag was gone. Now, the bag carried the items that I thought were most crucial to my identity, because once you leave a job or you leave your home and you're sort of untethered on the road, you really are in a sense of discovering who you are again. But I carried some items that I thought were me, right? So they were my journals, my camera, the things that spoke to being a reporter, a recorder of life. And those were the things that were in the bag, and they were all gone.
And so what did you do?
Well, I panicked, and I felt really sick. And then I decided that I needed to retrace and look for the bag. Maybe it's just sitting on the side of the road, hopeful, but not really hopeful. And along the way, it was not there. And I ran into this policeman who I thought was trying to help me, but he was actually just trying to get people to speak English so that they could help me figure out. He didn't know what was going on. And I was told that I needed to then go to the police station and file a report. And so that's what I did, hoping that the police would find it.
And you were advised to put an ad in the paper.
I was, by a waiter at the hotel I was staying at, and he was telling me that everyone reads the newspaper, and I was like, oh, I just don't believe that, you know. And turned out he was right, and everyone does read the newspaper there, or at least has access to somebody who can read it to them. The news is very important in India. They had, at that time, 7 English language newspapers sold in New Delhi. And that's just alongside of every day, right? And that's alongside the Hindi and the Bengali and the other languages that are spoken in a city like New Delhi.
Now, there's a happy ending, though, to the case of the missing gear bag, and you get all your stuff back.
I do.
That's a miracle.
That was quite a miracle, yes, through a chance encounter with somebody who saw me hanging around the police station, and he noticed what he called a simple bullet, because a lot of foreigners who go to a country like India, they might trick out their motorcycle to be more like an easy rider type motorcycle, a chopper. But I had kept mine in its original condition with a few minor changes. I had Nana, my mechanic, changed the seat out to a lower saddle, a single seat saddle, as opposed to the bench saddle. That put my feet a little more firmly on the ground, which is what I needed. And so he noticed the motorcycle, and he was waiting for the man to get on the motorcycle, who must have been riding the motorcycle. And then when he saw me, he thought, well, maybe she's the man who's riding the motorcycle. So he came over and asked me. And of course, I didn't want to be bothered by him, so I was trying to make him go away until he said, you know, did you lose a bag? And that really got my attention.
Okay, so you got all your stuff back. You get back on the road. Now, tell me about one of these temples that you visited.
They're small and some are large. The largest Kali temple is in Calcutta, and that was the one that I was kind of making my way to at the end. But some are quite small. It just depends on where they're located.
Now, okay, along your journey, you find some romance. You have a chapter called Love, Hate, involving Samar is it Samar?
Yes.
And this is in Goa?
Yes.
Former Portuguese colony.
Yes.
So tell me about Samar.
Well, you know, when you're on the road for a long time by yourself, and the only conversations I was having with anybody was, do you have a room? How much is it? Making a dinner order, you know, those types of conversations. So it was really nice to find someone who I could have a conversation with. And he owned a restaurant there, and I got to know him. I wasn't there very long, but it was just really nice to be with somebody, again, to feel sort of connected to the world again when you've been on the road feeling so disconnected from everything.
And he wanted to show you the nightlife in Goa. And you take us to this club, and there's some interesting characters in this club.
You know, India, in my perspective, is full of interesting people. And they come from all walks of life. And Goa is very much a tourist destination for people from all around the world. It's a very relaxed, easy place to be. But in this disco, it was quite an interesting place. I'd never seen people like that before.
Would you call it like the flotsam and jetsam of the of the world that kind of gathers there sometimes?
I would say so, because I mean, these people just came from all walks of life, and they were a little, I kind of got a little concerned about myself, because I thought, boy, it would be easy to become one of these folks, you know, if you just let life slip away from you. That's kind of what they seem like to me.
Now, the chapter is entitled Love and Hate, so you go from one extreme to the other. They'll have to read all about that episode, too. We'll just kind of leave that a question mark there, what happens there, how that, anyway. Now, we go to the frightening accident, naked on the edge, the collision with your motorbike and a boy on a bicycle. And that's pretty harrowing.
Yes, that was a frightening experience. You know, I had gotten, so this was quite, I was coming up on the, I was on the south side of India just after Madras, and I was, the road was quite empty, and it was quite an unusual thing to be out on the road alone. So I kind of had gotten lulled into that. Plus, I was probably doing a no-no by listening to music while I rode. So I had this Lyle Lovett tape going in my head, and I was just kind of zoning out, I suppose. And this boy just appeared sitting in the middle of the road. And by the time I saw him and my brain recognized him and understood what it was to do, I ended up hitting him.
And you swerved off the road.
I was flipped, what they call a low side. So that means the motorcycle, when I hit, and I hit his front wheel of his bicycle, probably tried to swerve around him, but I don't really have a memory of what I actually did. But the motorcycle flipped out from underneath me. So it went skidding down the road in front of me, and I went skidding down the road after it. But I was unconscious and woke up with some people trying to remove my helmet. That's when I came to.
I guess you were wondering, too, about the boy's condition, too, when you came to.
Yes, I didn't know what had happened to him or, you know, how much I had injured him or anything like that. I knew that I was quite injured, or I felt like I needed to sort of assess myself when you're knocked out. Thankfully, I had the helmet on and I had full gear on. Even though it was 120 degrees in India, I still rode with jackets and gloves and boots and everything like that, because safety was always first, and because it's dangerous anyway on Indian roads. But the boy, I just thought we were alone in the middle of nowhere, and turns out you're never alone in India. So lots of people came out, very helpful people, very kind people, helped us both, you know, got us off the road and picked up all my things and got the motorcycle picked up and everything.
Now, there's an official that was involved in this investigation, I guess, and they wanted to take you to a large hospital, guess farther away from this village, and you said, I don't want to go there, and you ruined his program. And he is very official. And he likes to do things his way. And you kind of upset the cart there.
Yes. So he wanted to take me to, and probably wisely wanted to take me to a hospital in Madras, which was behind the direction that I had already passed through there. And I knew that I really was in no condition to ride in a city that had traffic like Madras in it. So,
and also you said, I don't want to backtrack.
Yeah, I never like to go backwards into things. You know, I don't like to backtrack in mm-hmm. life. I like to just keep moving forward. So, and so that's a kind of a phrase. People were kind of interested, like his program, and that's a phrase, you know, that just means plans for the day. So his program, whatever he had planned for the day, helping me was not part of it, but then he felt obligated to help me because he sort of came along and took over and spoke English and could communicate with me and help me get to a doctor in a village nearby.
We're talking to Connie Stambush. Her new travel memoir is Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India. Now, you were banged up, I guess, more than your motorcycle, which did survive. And the first care you received was less than adequate from this doctor in the village.
Yes, he was. You know, I knew where I was traveling in the world. So I carried medical supplies with me. And among those supplies were syringes, because I know in developing worlds, I don't really always know where those syringes come from. So I had syringes with me, which were on my motorcycle back at the crash site. So when they took me to this guy, he wasn't all that attentive or caring. And didn't really speak a lot to me. Just sort of, a rock had been driven up into my kneecap, so I had that kind of an injury. My leg was really ballooning up quite fast, and he wanted to give me an injection, and the nurse brought in this tray with this long needle. I had to be at least 3 feet long, you know? And I thought, no way are you putting that thing in me. I don't know where that's been. So I refused his treatment, so he refused to really do much for me. He didn't clean the wound or anything, mm-hmm. just kind of put a Band-Aid on it.
So then you took off with this official, and you were kind of shown off as a prize. And you were just wanted to get to this guy's place and get some rest, but he wanted to kind of, I guess, show you off to his friends.
Yes, yes. Westerners are quite an attraction, I would say, in many, many developing worlds. And I was quite a prize. I felt like a prize. I mean, he was just kept stopping all the time. And plus, he wanted to tell the story
sure.
of what had happened and how he was helping me, I suppose. I mean, he was speaking in not English, so I don't know what he was actually saying to any of these people. But yeah, he was quite interested in parading me around, I would say. And I just felt sick. You know, I had a concussion. I had really banged up ribs. I was worried some of them were broken. I could barely breathe. I couldn't bend my leg. My knee was all swollen. It was all I could do to get on the motorcycle. They had to hold it. And then I had to literally haul my leg over, you know, the injured leg over the motorcycle. And somebody else had to get it started for me because I couldn't kickstart it. So, yeah, I was just wanted to lay down.
Well, you were eager to get out of this village, getting out of Dodge there and move on. And you did finally receive some decent medical care.
Yes, yes. I did stay with him and his family for a few hours, I would say, and then knew that I really just needed to be on my own. So they did kindly escort me to a larger city a little ways off, and then I was able to see another doctor there who gave me some good treatment. And a few weeks on, I'd say, maybe days more, I got to a hospital where I was able to get an x-ray of my leg to see if anything really was injured. And it was just ravaged nerves and ligaments torn.
And I know along the way, we talked about you being a kind of a prize, a curiosity, a woman on a motorcycle alone in India. And I know you were approached by children and young girls, and they just wanted to touch you and talk to you and just kind of follow you around.
Oh, those little girls, they were just wonderful. They had a whole Pinky and her friends, I would say. When they saw the motorcycle, I guess they had also seen me arrive on the motorcycle. And they, when I stayed in the hotel, they lived in an area quite near the hotel. And they, you know, just wanted to come over and talk to a foreigner and you know, look at them and engage with them. And they were just they just wanted to take me home with them, which they did. That's not uncommon around the world, especially if you're on your own. A lot of people are inviting you into their home. It's a very common experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the ladies of a different order.
These were what they call in India hijras, and so they are what they call the third sex. And they are, I don't know what exactly in English, but they are men who are women and who live as women, but they're a subcaste, mm-hmm, within the caste. And they saw me and sort of latched on to me to join their little troop. I don't know what they were up to, but I didn't want anything to do with them. They were scary, scary people.
And they were intimidating and
threatening.
You just tried to break away from them.
Yeah. I found them to be very threatening. They were very aggressive. One in particular was very aggressive. She just was really insistent that I come with them and be a part of their group. And the people on the street no one came to my rescue. Eventually, the camera saved me, as people love to have their picture taken. So I offered to take their picture, and that's what got them away from me. And once the picture was taken, it seemed to sort of break whatever they had going on.
Now, you had a lot of good experiences with the local people, but some of the men saw you, I guess, as vulnerable and would try to take advantage of you.
I think that's kind of interesting, because really, as a woman alone on the motorcycle, they assumed first that I was a man. That they could tell I was a Westerner. No, Indians didn't dress that much in 120 degrees. You know, they weren't wearing all that gear and helmets and everything like that. So it was very clear that I was a Westerner. And they were, as a Westerner, they were very eager to get to know any Westerner. I had one experience that I really feel like expresses a lot of what happened. So I was stopped at this train crossing, and we were all waiting for the train to come, and it was super hot. And so I've got all this gear on, so I don't know when the train's going to come. So I decide I'll take off this gear. So before I started to take off any gear, men were all kind of coming very close. So in the Indian culture, they don't have the social space and distance that we have in the United States. So they're quite comfortable being quite close to each other. And so they didn't have any problem being close to me. It wasn't a kind of a no-no or anything. Like if you're talking to somebody in the United States and they're getting a little too close, we know to sort of step back. And that is just not part of the Indian culture. And so they were all quite close and curious and, you know, trying to peer inside and see who I was, because I only had a helmet on, but I had a scarf wrapped around me and then sunglasses on. So, you know, you couldn't really tell who I was. And then as I started to take off the gear to reveal myself as a woman, these men were suddenly like, whoa. And they all just stepped back because they were not prepared for this. And this allowed for a group of tribal women who were watching from the far sides to then move in and really sort of, again, touch and compare, you know, like my hair to their hair and my skin to their skin. And just,
you think they were envious of your freedom?
I don't know. I think they were just thrilled to find something so different, I guess, and so similar. I don't know. They were very happy, fluttering all around me.
Now, you also traveled, and now we have Hinduism and Buddhism also prevalent in India, among the many religions and sects there. Now, you stayed at a compound at the birthplace of Buddhism, and there you met, in your chapter, Mia Moore, an ex-monk named Antonio.
He,
handsome brute.
Yes, he was Italian, and it's funny how I mean, the Buddhists have a saying, don't believe everything you think. And I think that's very accurate in this situation because, I don't know, maybe the loneliness of the road and the isolation of the road made me hungry for, you know, other companionships and things, just meeting people, just connecting with people again. So I had taken a meditation course and was a part of it was silent meditation. So the goal was to not, you couldn't read, you couldn't talk, you couldn't look at anybody, right? So when you're in silent meditation, you should be like completely silent and in your own head. You weren't, we were discouraged from journaling or anything like that. It was just to sit with our thoughts. So once he arrived, I had been in my head for 3 days. And then I just began to think, you know, well, we had this connection, you know, which we probably didn't, but that was just in my head. And I should have heeded that advice to not believe everything I think.
Well, then robbers entered the compound. There was gunfire. People were wounded. And then it turns out Antonio was not the shining knight in armor, was he?
He was very human, you know, which is very hard to take when you think you're falling in love with someone who you don't even know, and they turn out to be very human.
So he was frightened and like everybody else.
Like he should have been, right?
Yeah. But yeah, these robbers came in. They a couple of people were, I think a lady was shot.
It was accidental, but still we had been warned that. So the state was Bihar, and it was known for its kind of lawlessness even at that time. I'm not sure about today, but anyway, a policeman had come to the compound to sort of warn us to, you know, not go anywhere, that there was rumors that this would happen, and we didn't really believe it. The compound felt safe enough. It had, you know, fence and had a guard and all of that kind of stuff. But the monks, the more dedicated people, were staying at the back of the property in huts, and I was up front in more established kind of housing. And the robbers came over the back wall, and they had guns, and they got startled. The way I understand it is that they got startled when people started rushing and a gun went off, and two people were sort of sprayed with a kind of a buckshot type thing.
Now, coming up, we're going to talk about the final leg of the journey, the search for self. Did Connie find it? And life back home in the U.S., being that national motorcycle safety instructor. And what's next for this woman who doesn't like to backtrack and reminds us you can go anywhere, do anything, and be anything you want. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Connie Stambush, author of the newly published travel memoir, Untethered, A Woman's Search for Self on the Edge of India, her adventures alone on a motorcycle through villages and cities, battling hardships while drinking in the many cultural wonders of the subcontinent. Now, Connie, tell us about the cover of your book, Untethered.
A very talented coworker of mine worked with me on this. Her name is Terry Bischoff, and she works at USI with me. And I had an idea of what I wanted the cover to be, and so we collaborated on this. This is her design, part of my collaboration. We were very intentional about the making it look like India and using these very Indian colors in it to make it very bright and inviting. And then so she hand drew this herself on a pad, and this is all her original art and her concepts based on my, you know, wishes like that. So
now the book is now available?
It is available. I'm selling it. It's sold on Amazon and Barnes & Noble as well. Also, I have one copy put in the Evansville Library.
Now, before we start this final leg of the journey back to your starting point in Delhi, let's talk about your role as a national motorcycle safety instructor. What's that all about?
Well, when I knew that I was going to do this journey, I was home for a very brief period of time visiting my family, and I thought I better learn how to ride a motorcycle. So I took the Abate of Indiana motorcycle course here, and it was a Robert Stadium at the time, I think. I took that course, and then they taught me how to be a writer. It was a three-day course. They taught me how to think like a writer. And then, of course, I went back to India and had to practice everything that they had taught me. And then when I returned from India after this journey, I wanted to take that course again because I was probably going to buy a motorcycle here. And after taking the course, I got recruited by one of the other instructors to become an instructor because there weren't a lot of women who were instructors at that time.
So do you ride still?
I do not ride currently. I sold my last motorcycle a few years ago.
Now, your famous motorcycle, Kali, the Bullet, whatever happened to Kali?
You know, when I left India, I was determined to try to figure out a way to get that motorcycle back into the United States. Now, it was made in India, manufactured in India, and made for India. So that means in the United States, all the gears and the brakes are on the right side and the gears and shifting are on the left side. I think that's right. And but in India, on the Royal Enfield Bullet that's manufactured there, those are crossed. So you've got a front brake and on one hand and then the rear brake on the opposite side. So the front brake right and the rear brake left side. And then the clutch on the front left and the gears on the right side. So that is not standardized to be... It's not acceptable in the United States. You can't have that kind of motorcycle in the United States unless it's grandfathered in. And it wasn't old enough to be grandfathered in, and it would cost too much money to change its emission systems and everything like that. So I left it with my mechanic, Nana, figuring that I would maybe find some way to bring it back. And then, of course, the longer I was here without it, the more reality set in. And then I was contacted by a Scottish oilman who wanted to buy the motorcycle. He had read about it on a blog that I had posted, and so I ended up selling it to him.
Okay, now we're on this final stretch to Delhi, and I know you're right, it was cold, bitter cold, but you were determined to roll into town, and you made it.
Yes, yeah. So I left in, I was 5 months on the road, and by the time I guess I left in July then, by the time I was headed back to India, it was December, and I was back up north again. So it's pretty cold riding a motorcycle in December. So I was quite bundled up by then.
And you said someone who keeps records of these journeys says that you may have set some kind of record.
Yes, a man named Bernard Tersch has this motorcycle, this international motorcycle database that he keeps track of. And somehow I got connected with him, and I am listed on his, or at least I was at one point, listed on his website as being the first woman to have ridden a motorcycle solo around the edge of India. Now, that's just a record, whether, you know, I'm sure others have done, you know, many more adventurous things than I have, but...
Did you have an odometer for this trip?
That's very funny that you ask. Yes, yes, I did. And in fact, when I returned from India, that speedometer stopped working, and I had my mechanic replace it, but I kept the original speedometer, and so it's at my house now. I keep it just kind of on display.
So how many miles did you trek on this journey?
Officially, this was, I think, just under 7,000. I have the official number in the book, and there's some significance to how those numbers add up as well. But 7,000 miles on the roads of India really does take 5 months. But 7,000 miles on Western roads or interstates here, you could do it in days.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your title, Searching for Yourself on the Edge of India. So did you find yourself, Connie Stambush?
I found a lot of myself. And I learned that there are more than one self within us all. And some of those selves we don't like, but all of those selves we have to embrace because they are who we are.
So are you still searching?
I believe it's probably, well, I know a lot more about who I am than I ever did before. But I think every new experience that we're ever in teaches us something else about ourselves that we didn't really know.
And we were talking earlier, I think your journey would be a great Hollywood movie. Do you agree?
I agree. And if anybody has any Hollywood connections out there.
any casting for this role?
Well, I don't know. Who did you recommend a little
Charlize
while ago?
Charlize Theron.
Yes, she would be good.
She would be very good in that. Now, you had these frightening episodes, which make the best reading, of course, in the book. But you also wrote that along the way you met these hundreds of open-hearted Indians who helped you complete the journey. We don't want to not mention them.
Yes, by far, 99% of everybody I met was just happy and opening and welcoming and encouraging, and everybody just wanted to help. It's a very, very, very helpful culture. People want to help other people.
Do you want to go back?
I have been back
before.
I went back in 2007, so about 10 years after I went back. And it was very interesting because when I lived in Delhi, I would often be down in an area called Connaught Place, and there would be a woman down there who would be selling postcards. She had kind of like a little patch on the pavement, and I would often talk to her a lot. And when I went back 10 years later, she was still there. And so we had a conversation with each other again.
Now, any new travels planned?
Well, in the pandemic, we really can't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's say post-pandemic.
Post-pandemic, yes. I don't really know. I have been to a lot of countries, and I have spent a lot of years on the road. It's kind of nice to be settled into one place again. I like the day trips, but for me, that kind of long-range travel, being on the road for weeks or months at a time, is not something I see. But then again, I didn't see it before, so it doesn't mean it won't happen.
Well, you always have the book to thumb through to relive those great memories. Connie Stambush, author of Untethered, a travel memoir. It's a great read. So thanks for being my guest and sharing your adventure with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger, Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management.